Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the middle of Craig Atkinson's new documentary, we watch as a South Carolina woman's home is raided by the local SWAT team. Armed with long guns, wearing ballistic helmets and bulletproof vests, the team smashes her windows and breaks down the door. The next day, the documentary crew goes back to the home to interview the woman.
First thing I asked, y'all looking for a terrorist? Y'all think a terrorist in here? Because that's the kind of feeling that I had. They're looking for something really strong, really important. I mean, government stuff.
Well, what they were looking for was drugs. And what they found was what they called a, quote, personal amount of marijuana. That was just one of the 50 to 80,000 SWAT deployments across the country every year. The number was closer to 2,000 back in the 1980s. So that 40-fold increase in SWAT deployments, that's the subject of Atkinson's documentary. It's called Do Not Resist, and it won this year's Best Documentary Award at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it will be screening tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts. Craig Atkinson will also be there on a panel discussion that follows. But first, he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. Thanks for being interested.
Well, so tell us first, what inspired you to follow this story of the militarization of local police forces?
Sure. My father was a police officer for 29 years outside of the Detroit area, and he was actually a SWAT officer for 13 of those years. He retired in 2002, and I really hadn't thought about anything to do with SWAT or police work until, quite honestly, that I saw the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, and it was the first time that I had seen the level of equipment that I subsequently found out while making this film was gifted to law enforcement after 9/11, the DHS grants of $34 billion piled onto the DOD grants, which was $5 billion. So we're looking at $39 billion, you know, after 9/11. And so my father's era missed that whole wave of funding. So as I'm sitting there watching the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, it was the first time that I had seen that investment in equipment. And I was curious to know what had happened.
So I guess you're specifically talking about the Watertown manhunt,
correct,
where we saw the deployment of all sorts of very heavily militarized equipment in the search for the Tsarnaevs. Interesting. So before we get further into what you found in your documentary about how those billions of dollars have been put into play, can you tell us a little bit about what your father's experience as a SWAT team member was? What was a SWAT team like
His department started a SWAT team in 1989, and that was a response to some of the violence that people were seeing in various communities. The North Hollywood shooting is often referenced, where the two individuals donned body armor, robbed the bank, and police were so ill-equipped that they had to go to pawn shops in order to get the equipment necessary to neutralize that threat. When they formed the SWAT team, it was an era where they would send a couple officers to a training module for a weekend, and they would come back and be the SWAT commander. So it wasn't regulated. It's not that regulated now. But to give you some context, my father was on SWAT for 13 years. He did 29 search warrants that entire time.
For the whole 13 years?
For the entire time. And, we're going out with SWAT departments or police departments and going out on SWAT raids. And in conjunction with the film, in a similar size department is doing 3 to 4 raids a day, over 200 a year. And so there's just been an absolute significant mission creep, if you will, with the deployment of SWAT. It's almost become a routine part of police work, whereas my dad's era, it was reserved for the most violent, most specific use, and oftentimes was a barricaded gunman or a hostage situation or a very, high-risk entry search warrant. But, as we were going out with the police departments around the country, they kept telling us that it was going to be used for terrorist events and ISIS, but every single time we went out, it was for drug offenses, and I can report that we never found anything. One time it was a gram of weed, one time it was a bowl of weed, but in the process, destroying the home and oftentimes arresting the people and seizing their assets, even though that it was such a small quantity.
Interesting. Well, you in the movie Do Not Resist also include clips. You take us inside how these officers are trained.
Mm.
And you have a clip of a seminar that's given by Dave Grossman. He's a retired Army lieutenant colonel who teaches both FBI agents and police officers across the country. Here's a little bit of that.
You fight violence. What do you fight it with? Superior violence. Righteous violence, huh?
Violence is your tool. Violence is your enemy. Violence is the realm we operate in. You are men and women of violence. You must master it, or it will destroy you. Yeah?
And then he goes on and talks about what officers have told him about their experiences on these teams.
Cop says gunfight, bad guys down, I'm alive. Finally get home at the end of the incident, and they all say, the best sex I've had in months. Both partners are very invested in some very intense sex.
Tell us about this.
Well, Dave Grossman has been teaching law enforcement for the last 18 years. Prior to teaching law enforcement, he spent 25 years in the military helping the military improve their kill ratio. So historically speaking, it's very difficult to get humans to kill other humans. The kill ratio in World War II was about 15 to 30%. By Vietnam, it was 90%. And how they got soldiers to kill more was through a process of desensitizing the individual and teaching killing through pop-up targets. So it becomes a conditioned response. And, you know, this may be very effective in you know, surviving a war zone. But, you know, there's 63 million police-citizen interactions every year. And if you're taking that mentality into basic police-citizen interactions, I think we can start to see where there may be issues. It's interesting to point out that Philando Castile, the gentleman who we saw life slip away via Facebook last July, you know, the officer that killed him had attended one of Dave Grossman's seminars. And this is an individual who got pulled over at a traffic stop. There's a four-year-old daughter in the back seat, and he's reaching for his wallet and gets shot six times. It's just very interesting to know that this officer went through that style of training. I can only imagine what if it would have been any different if he had been taught de-escalation training. And I think that that's really what communities are asking of their police officers these days, is more of a de-escalation versus you are men and women of violence.
So you're saying that they are asking or trying to get them to learn more about de-escalation.
Well, I think there's a trend in law enforcement of officers that are recognizing that they're grossly unprepared for, you know, the day-to-day call-outs. I'll say that when, you know, we went on 20-odd ride-alongs, and almost every single call-out that we went out on was a call-out that required the officer to de-escalate the situation. And, you know, I found officers grossly unprepared to de-escalate situations. However, if it turned violent or if it caused for a violent reaction, you know, I saw them very prepared to handle something like that. So, you know, I did see a disconnect between the style of training and what we're actually seeing on a day-to-day basis in the community.
Let's talk for another minute about some of the numbers that you were telling us earlier about how much has been spent on the militarization of local police, because there is a scene in the documentary, again, it's called Do Not Resist, that takes place in a city council meeting in Concord, New Hampshire. And members there at the city council meeting vote to actually accept a $250,000 grant, federal grant, to buy a Bearcat armored vehicle. And a Concord resident tells the council, terrorism works because it makes people irrational and it makes them destroy themselves. So, I mean, this is a city council voting for this. Is a lot of the impulse for escalating the how police are equipped just coming from local citizens and councils themselves?
Well, in this scenario, the DHS basically offers a grant, and that requires a city council vote. And when a police department approaches the city council saying, hey, would you like a $250,000 for free to help protect officers, it's very hard for elected officials to go against that. In that particular meeting, you know, there was very compelling testimony from citizens saying, hey, this is, we would rather not have this in our community, but the city council voted 11-4 and got the Bearcat anyway. So again, you have citizens speaking out against that, and it's just very hard for elected officials to go against something that's earmarked for officer safety.
And there's also the question of how closely, if at all, the usage of this equipment is tracked, right?
Yes, there's actually no tracking data as for how and when and why this equipment is being used. There was one state that required it, and that was Maryland, and that's only because the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, had his home raided by mistake, wrong door entry, and his dog was killed. And because it happened to someone in power, he moved it through the legislation and was able to get reporting statistics from 2010 to 2014. It came up on a ballot initiative in 2014, and they dropped it off of it. Well, so there's no longer any reporting statistics nationwide for how SWAT is deployed.
Well, I want to play a little clip that in support of that, because you do have a scene of a Senate meeting on the police use of military equipment. It takes place in 2014. And in this clip, we're going to hear Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri questioning Alan Estevez of the Department of Defense and Brian Kamoy of the Department of Homeland Security.
I want to make sure that the record is clear. Do any of you now have any policy that requires you to track any kind of usage data for the equipment you're providing that is considered military grade? Yes or no?
No. No.
Not good.
Not good.
Not good. You know, it was a very compelling scene, and I can say that while I was filming it, I got a surge of patriotism, you can almost say, because here are elected officials trying to bring basically the military-industrial complex to task. And during the exchange, I thought our elected officials were making very compelling points. But, you know, fast forward 8 or 9 months later when we're looking for any type of reforms, and there weren't any, and nothing came of that meeting. So it was, you know, disheartening to see that despite our elected officials trying to bring these groups to task, they weren't able to. So it begs the question, well, who's in charge?
Mm-hmm. You know, as you probably well know, the ACLU did a report, I believe this year, about the number of people who had been killed, innocent people who had been killed during some of these SWAT raids. One of them that they talked about happened in 2013 in Framingham, Massachusetts, where a gentleman named Uri Stamps, was lying on the ground, and he was in his home, and he was shot by an officer during a raid because the officer actually lost his balance and tripped and shot Mr. Stamps and killed him. And it turns out, in fact, that the Framingham police chief, Stephen Carl, actually disbanded the department's SWAT team two and a half years after the shooting of Mr. Stamps. And also just in Revere, not that long ago, we had another swatting of a house of Moroccan immigrants. And the question is, why were they even called there to begin with? So, I mean, that's sort of a little background of what's been happening in Massachusetts. But let me ask you, you've shown this documentary to members of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. What's their response?
Well, you know, I could say, well, from my own family, I showed it to my father, and he was stunned to see that SWAT had become a routine part of police work. I mean, every single felony search warrant in the St. Louis County area is served by the SWAT team, and you can think of plenty of felony search warrants that don't require a SWAT team. They were raiding homes for code enforcement. Someone didn't pay their gas bill. I mean, we've seen around the country.
A SWAT team.
Correct. And we've seen around the country SWAT teams going in for student loans being not paid. We saw Gibson guitars being raided for using illegal rare wood. And so, you know, for my father, who came from an era of 3,000 SWAT raids a year, and now we're up between somewhere 50,000 and 80,000, he was stunned to see the frequency in which SWAT is deployed. We also had an opportunity to show the NYPD, essentially, at the John Jay Criminal Justice College. And it's a feeder school for the NYPD. Over 300 officers were in attendance. Many got up and said, "Thanks so much for making this film. It reflects reality." There was a SWAT commander who immediately got up and tried to put some distance between what the NYPD does and what Dave Grossman teaches, and I thought that was very interesting. So I do see.
But when they say it reflects reality, is it that is it a reality they approve of, or a reality that they want to, you know, stand down from?
That's a great question. You know, I see a lot of officers trapped in the middle, where they are working hard to change the culture of their department, but, you know, just like the community who's been trying to explain this for decades, you know, these group of officers have a hard time going against a very closed-in, very insular culture. So we're almost providing an example of what many of them in law enforcement have been speaking about.
Well, Craig Atkinson is director of the new documentary Do Not Resist. It's about the militarization of local police. It's screening tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts through November 26th, and there's also a panel discussion tonight featuring Craig, the Boston Police Camera Action Team, and the National Center for Race Amity, and the ACLU Massachusetts. We've got information about that at our website, RadioBoston.org. Craig, thank you so very much for coming in today.
Thank you for your interest. I appreciate it.
Well, we're back in 90 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.